268, we are going to begin with verse 29, or Chavtes, and this is an episode which I think we're somewhat acquainted with, and that is the episode where Yaakov blesses Ephraim and Menashe, his grandchildren, the sons of Yosef, and in the process, he also asks Yosef to bury him to make sure that he gets buried in the land of Israel. Take me out of Egypt, bury me in the land of Israel. Okay, so we're all somewhat familiar with this, and what I'd like to do today is share with you an approach which is radically different than the simple approach, but I think it answers many compelling questions about this passage. Okay, so with that introduction, my hope is we're going to review some of the more classical approaches over here, but then I'd like to expand ourselves a little bit and share something which is very, very different. So just keep your mind open to a very, very different way of understanding what we're about to read. So again, page 268, Pasuk Chavtes, or verse 29. Vayikruvu Yemei Yisrael Lamus. The days of Israel, meaning Yaakov, were numbered. He was getting close to death. He was not a young man at this time. And he realizes that he is close to death. So what does he do? Vayikra Livno LeYosef. He calls his son Yosef. Vayomer lo, and he says to him, Imna matzasi chen beinecha, if I find favor in your eyes, simna yadcha tachas yorechi, place your hand by my thigh. What is that all about? That is, in the ancient world, this is the equivalent, this is the way they would take an oath. Okay, why do they take an oath by holding onto one's thigh? Some suggest that the symbolism was that a thigh holds us up, our legs hold our bodies up, so that's the idea behind it. Others argue, a very interesting approach, I believe Rav Hirsch suggests, that nowadays, what do we take an oath on? If we need to take a swear, we'd hold a Bible, a Sefer Torah, right? That's what we would do. So back in the day, what holy items they have? None. They only had one mitzvah. What was the one mitzvah they had? Circumcision. So by placing the hand by the thigh, it's placing the hand next to the circumcised area, and therefore, it's a way of connecting to holiness. Okay, so it's a fascinating idea that's the idea. One way or another, this is how they took an oath in the ancient world, or at least the Hebrews, our ancestors took oaths in the ancient world by holding someone's thigh. V'asisa imadi chesed ve'emes. Do for me kindness and truth. Alna sikbareini b'mitzrayim. Do not bury me in Egypt. Okay, so again, he's getting close to dying. Our commentators learn from here, a person should be planful. You know, death is, we're all, at one point, God willing, at an old age, but we're all going to, we don't live forever. And so Yaakov realizes that he's his mortality at this moment. And so therefore he starts to plan. Okay, so he calls his son Yosef. He makes his son Yosef swear that he is going to not bury him in Egypt and rather take him back to the land of Israel, to what's then called Canaan. The first question we have to address is, why does he call Yosef? He has 12 sons. Why does he call Yosef? And two explanations are given. One suggestion is that he brought him down. Yosef caused Yaakov to come down to Egypt, and therefore he's responsible of making sure that he leaves Egypt. You know, you caused the problem, you solve it. You know, if it's because of Yosef, okay, that's a midrashic teaching. Rashi says very simply, who is the one who had the ability to bring him out of Egypt? Yosef. Yosef had the keys to the palace. Yosef was the one who had all the political connections. He was more or less in charge of the land. And therefore it goes to him. Okay. We'll see. There's another explanation behind this, but let's keep on reading for now. Verse 30. Vishachavti imavosai. I will lie with my forefathers, with my fathers. He's being asked to be buried in the plot of land that his family is being buried in. And we actually learn many important... Sorry? Ma'arat HaMachpelah, that's right. And there is a deep, great halachic significance in being buried with family. You know, just parenthetically, there's a law that you're not allowed to reinter someone in Jewish law. If someone was buried, you're not allowed to take them out of the... We don't take them out of the grave. There are a couple of exceptions. It's a big, big discussion about when you're allowed to. One of the exceptions is if someone is buried in a grave but not near their family plot, you are allowed to remove an individual to go from being buried by themselves, you know, in a regular cemetery, but to be buried with a family plot, there's great, premium placed on that. And similarly, we find Yaakov over here saying, it's not just, he doesn't just give him the geographic location, bury me in Ma'arat Machpelah. He says, bury me with my family. There's value, for whatever mystical reasons, there's value being buried with one's parents.
Learn from this that's why we do that.
Correct. Well, yeah, this is one of the indications that this is permitted. Exactly. Yeah, we're gonna. Yeah, this. Yeah, exactly. Unasasani mitzram, carry me from Egypt. Ukvartani mikvorasam, bury me in those burial places. Vayomar, Yosef says, Anochi aseh chidvarecha. I will do like you said. Okay. So far, so good. Everything seems like it's going smoothly. However, the next verse is a very strange one. 31, or Lamed Aleph, Vayomer, Yosef says, Hishava li. He says to Yosef, swear to me, right? Because what did Yosef say? I'll do it. It almost sounds like when my kids talk, you know, like, you know, did you take it? I didn't take it. Promise me. I promise. You know, they'll say like something, like some way of avoiding promising. So Yaakov says, do it. He says, I'll do it. But Yaakov's not content with that, right? It's very interesting that Yaakov is really emphasizing, we're on page 268, verse 31. Yaakov is not content. Yaakov is not content with Yosef giving him his word. He says, I want you to take an oath. Okay, so again, we have to come back to the question of why he's so emphatic why he's so emphatic about Yosef really, truly committing to taking him out of Egypt. Does he not trust Yosef? Is Yosef not trustworthy? It seems very strange that he has to go to such lengths with his beloved son.
But Yosef is not the royal.
Excellent, excellent. Very good. So Rashi says this exact approach that Jenny's saying. Rashi says that Yaakov recognized that perhaps Yosef's boss, i.e. Pharaoh, Paro, would hold him back. And therefore he said, it's not enough for you to say you're going to do it, which I trust you, but if you make an oath, the Egyptians will respect that and they'll let you go. Okay, that's one approach. Good. Again, I'm going to come back. So far we're learning it more the classical approach, but we're going to come back and we'll see what a very, very different approach. But let's, good, you're in very good company. Then let's see what happens at the end of this verse, the end of Pasuk Lamed Aleph. Vayishtachu Yisrael al Rosh Hamita. Yisrael, i.e. Yaakov, bows now. After Yosef finishes speaking to him, he bows. Where does he bow? Not to Yosef, but he bows to the head of his bed. Towards the head of his bed. So you can imagine whether he's lying down or he's sitting up or maybe he's standing near his bed and Yosef and him are talking. Yosef tells him, I'll do it. I'll do it. Now, you would imagine as a matter of thanking him or something like that, Yosef is a dignitary at the end of the day. You would imagine he would bow to him, you know, thank you. Instead, he bows, but he bows to the head of his bed. Why does he bow to the head of his bed? Anybody? So Rashi says something that, and we also learn a halacha from here, that the Shechina, the divine presence, rests on the head of the bed of those who are ill. Okay? We actually learn halacha, so you're not supposed to sit above the bed of the ill person because it's disrespectful to the divine presence that is resting above their bed. A bit of a mystical idea. Why are we learning that over here? It seems very strange. But that's how Rashi explains. He says that the reason that Yaakov is bowing to the head of the bed is because the Shechina is there. Now you have to ask yourself a question. Okay, let's say the Shechina is there. Why is he doing this now? He's all morning. Yosef should be, Yaakov should be bowing to the head of the bed. Bow to the head of the bed. The Shechina is here, right? Why is he doing it in this context? He just finished speaking to Yosef. Why does he bow to the head of the bed now? So the Hamek Davar, the Netziv, from Natali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, says a fascinating idea, and we're going to keep on coming back to this Netziv. He says the reason he bows to the head of the bed is deliberately because Yosef is there. He says Yosef is there, and really he should be bowing to thank him. And Yaakov does want to thank him. He's grateful. But if he bowed to Yosef, what would it indicate? What does a bow indicate? It indicates submission. It says, you are above me. I bow to you out of submission. Yaakov wanted to make it abundantly clear that he was not giving any credence or not elevating Yosef. Let's take a step back. There is a major question that has been under the undercurrent of so many of the last episodes that we learned in the Torah. And that is, who is going to assume the leadership of the family? There's Avram, and then there's Yitzchak, and then there's Yaakov. So those are simple. Yitzchak and Yishmael have some tension, Yitzchak comes up. You know, Yaakov and Esav have some tension, Yaakov takes the mantle. And now you have the 12 tribes. We know this tension ultimately begins the whole story of Yosef's sale. Who is going to be the leader? And so Yaakov is very careful right now about who he, what he does, his interactions. They're all going to be interpreted by everyone around him. Who's supposed to be the next one? Who's going to take over? You know, this is a big question, a major question. Look at the infighting that sometimes takes place in Hasidic movements, about he has two sons or whatever, it's two sons, a son-in-law, who's the next one? And then you have Hasidic movements which have split into, broken apart because, there was, one time he gave him, a pat on the back and one time Yaakov over here, he wants to thank his son, he wants to bow to his son in recognition, but he's very careful to bow the other way to impress upon him, I'm not appointing you as the next leader, okay? We'll come back to that point, but that's interesting that he's doing that over here. He could just say, Toda Rabah, thank you very much. Instead, he bows, but let's take this a little bit further. Yaakov could have just ignored you. He said, thank you, Yosef. Instead, he bows and he bows away. What's the implication? It's not just that he's not giving Yosef credence. It's almost like an actively not giving Yosef credence. By bowing in the other direction, he's saying, it's not just that he's doing something neutral. He's saying, you are not the leader, right? There's a message here. He's doing something a little stronger. He could have just remained neutral and just said, thank you. By bowing away, he's saying, and you are not the one I'm going to bow to. Let's come back to that, okay? We're going to keep on building and building. Okay, let's now start chapter 48, Memches Aleph, page 268. Vayhi acharei hadvarim ha'ele. Okay, now this is another episode. I don't know, as a child, I used to merge these two episodes into one. In my head, this was one long episode. But in truth, you read the psukim, it's very clear that we just finished one entire interaction. The first interaction was Yaakov calling Yosef, asking him to ensure that he is buried in Canaan, in the land of Israel, okay? New episode, okay? Period. Over. New chapter, new episode. Vayhi acharei hadvar me'ila. It was a later point. Vayomer li Yosef, and was told to Yosef, Hinei avicha chole, your father is sick. Vayikach es shnei vanavimo. So Yosef takes his two sons with him, es Menashe ves Ephraim. He takes both Menashe and Ephraim. Vayagid li Yaakov, and it was told to Yaakov, Vayomer, and it was said, Hinei bincha Yosef ba elecha. Your son Yosef, he is coming to you. Vayischazek Yisrael. Yisrael, Yaakov clearly at this point is quite ill. It's hard for him. He's lying down. He strengthens himself. Vayeshev al hamita, and he sits on the bed. We're now on the next page. We're on page 270 or 271. Vayomer, now he gives a little speech to Yosef. And let's read this speech carefully. Vayomer Yaakov al Yosef. Yaakov now turns to Yosef and says, Kel Shakai, it's one of the names of God, Nira Eli beluz be'eretz Kanan. God appeared to me in Luz. Where is Luz? Luz is in the lands of Canaan. Vayavarech osi, and he gave me a blessing. Vayomer Eli, and he said to me, Hinani mafrecha virbisicha. I will make you fruitful, and I will multiply you. Unesaticha lekal amim, I'll make you into a collective of nations, plural, okay? Not just a nation. He doesn't say I'm going to make you into an am, right? Plural. He says amim, which is plural. Venasati sa'aretz hazos lezaracha acharecha achuzas olam. And I will give this land to you and to your descendants after you as an eternal inheritance. Okay? Fine. That's all the introduction. Ve'ata, and now says Yaakov. Shnei vanacha, your two sons, hanoladim lecha be'eretz Mitzrayim, who were born in Egypt. Adboi elecha Mitzrayima, who were born before I came to you in Egypt. Seems like a bit of an extraneous piece of information. Is he telling, reminding Yosef when his children were born? If he's going to pick up some medication at the pharmacy? If you remember, forgot the year, oh, don't remember, they were born before I came to you in Egypt. Why is he reiterating that now? Lihem, they are mine. Ephraim u'menashe, kiruvein v'shimon yeli. Ephraim and Menashe will be to me like Ruvain and Shimon. Okay, sounds good. Sounds very good. So let's ask, the first question we have to ask is, why does Yaakov mention the promise of the land of Israel in this context? In other words, the first thing he says, I'm going to make you into a great nation. Okay. So we understand that he's saying that your children are part of this great nation. Why does he mention to him the inheritance of the land? God said to me, he's going to give me the land. Why is that relevant over here? Thoughts? Good. We'll come back to that. Good. I want to come back to that point. I think the simplest point is, what does it mean that Ephraim and Menashe are going to be like Reuven and Shimon? What is the significance of that?
One of his own children.
Two of his children, Ephraim and Menashe. Two of his children. So what is the practical relevance? So this is a big debate. Some suggest, the Ramban, Nachmanides suggests, that the significance is that they are going to, that you, Yosef, are going to receive some form, I'm sorry, not the rabbi, Rashi, that understands that there's going to be a larger inheritance to the family of Yosef. And therefore, the whole significance of the double portion is the land of Israel. So he says, I'm going to make you into a great nation, right? And I'm going to give you a multiplicity of children, and I'm going to give you the land of Israel. What's the relevance? The relevance is that your children are going to get a bigger inheritance in that land of Israel, which was given to me. Okay, that would be a very good explanation. What's a little strange, which is just a parenthetical to what we're really focusing on, and I mentioned this on online earlier this week for those who follow, this notion that Yaakov is still playing favorites is kind of odd, right? The whole story, the whole episode, the whole saga of Yosef being sold to Egypt took place, why? Because Yaakov played favorites with Yosef, and the brothers were jealous, and they go ahead and they sell him to Egypt because they're jealous of him. So you would think after all these years of suffering, Yaakov would have learned his lesson. Instead, what does he do? He says, hey, Yosef, come over. I'm going to give your family something special. Really? All over again, right? Like you didn't learn your lesson after all these years. It's strange. It's very strange. So Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky says, and again, this is parenthetical. We'll come back to the main point I'm trying to build. But he says something beautiful, which I just want to share. And that is, he says, yes, favoritism is bad, but equally bad is when we treat everyone the same. When we assume that everyone is exactly the same, that's also a mistake. It's also a mistake, right? Think about it in the context of children in a home. You want to make sure no child thinks that they are the favorite child. That would be terrible if a child thinks that they're a favorite child. At the same time, if you treat every child the same, you're asleep at the wheel. You're not doing your job. Each child has wildly different characteristics, has wildly different responsibilities. And therefore, on the one hand, yes, you need to ensure that each child knows how beloved they are. At the same time, to say, oh, he's treating them differently, and therefore that's a problem, that's foolish as well. We don't treat everyone and everything the exact same. There are differences in the world, right? It's a foolish idea to think that there is, that everything is the same. We know we're all different. We all need different things to care for ourselves. So, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky suggests that, there's two ways to understand why he's giving a double blessing to Ephraim and Manasseh. One is that they need more spiritual assistance. Because of the fact that they were born in Egypt, they had less of a connection to Yaakov, and therefore they need more spiritual assistance. And therefore he's giving an extra bracha to Ephraim and Manasseh. That's one way of looking at it. Alternatively, I'll just share another approach, and that is that, let me ask you a question. Why in general does the firstborn, according to Jewish law, why does the firstborn get a double portion? What's that all about?
He has more responsibility.
More responsibility, right? With great responsibility comes great power. Great power comes great responsibility. Other way around, right? That's exactly it, right? The oldest son, they're charged with caring for the entire family. This is the way the world worked until not that long ago, right? That the oldest son, they say, if you look at the boat, the people coming on by ship to the United States, before it was the United States, to the Americas, before, in the early years, almost none of them were firstborns. Why? Because all the firstborn children, they had land back in England, right? It was the second who was beholden, who was taken care of by the oldest. He said, I want to start on my own, right? So the eldest would stay back in England. It was the younger children who made their way over here, right? Okay, it's a fascinating little tidbit. I don't know if it's accurate, but once heard that. Okay, so you would understand that if Yosef is the one who's charged with taking his father out of Egypt, then we understand he has greater responsibility. So with greater responsibility, he's going to get extra stuff as well. It's not, it kind of makes sense, okay? This, so far, we're still going within what I would call the simple understanding of this entire passage. Let's keep on reading. Umoladcha asher halata achareihem, the children that you were born to you afterwards, meaning it seems like Yosef had other children beyond Ephraim and Manasseh, lechayiyu, they're to you, al shem achem yikra'u b'nachalasam, they are going to be subsumed within their brother's inheritance. They don't get their own piece of land. It's just Ephraim and Manasseh. Subsequent children that are born to you, they don't get their own land. Okay, everything is sitting pretty until this next verse, which is bizarre. Does not belong here whatsoever. Verse 7, Pasuk, Zion, Pasuk Zion. Vani bevoi mipadan. Now Yaakov continues and seemingly goes on a very strange tangent. He says, when I was coming from Padan, what's Padan? Padan is when he came from his father-in-law, from Padan Aram, the Iraq area, he came from there. Mesa alai Rachel be'eretz Canaan baderech. Rachel died in Canaan while we were on the way. Be'od kivras aretz livro Ephrasa, and it was a distance to come to Ephrat. Ve'akbarel sham baderech Ephras he beis lachem, and therefore I buried her on the pathway. Beis Lechem, on the side of the road. Okay, on the side of the road in a place called Beis Lechem. I didn't bury her in Ma'arat HaMachpelah. Okay, so why does Yaakov mention this here?
Because of himself.
What do you mean?
He is so far away from Canaan.
So he's saying, and therefore what?
In other words, he buried her on the road.
Good, right.
But he wants to be in Machpelah.
Good. So what's he saying? So okay, according to Jenny, once again, you're good company. This is how Rashi understands it. He says that Yaakov over here is feeling a little self-conscious. He's saying, Yosef, I want you to take me all the way from Egypt, all the way to Hebron. That's a decent trip. Okay, it's not crazy long, but it's a nice trip, right? Your mother was born, died, not that far from Hebron. I didn't bury her there. So is on his conscience. He's apologizing. Again, he doesn't say the word, I'm sorry. Okay, it's ancient world. But he's basically saying, there's some implicit apology saying, I know I didn't do everything I could have maybe for your mother. But, but at the end of the day, could you do that for me? I know I didn't carry your mother as far as I could have. Could you nonetheless carry me all the way back to Israel. Great approach. What's the question you should all have on this?
What does that do with the previous verse?
What in the world, right? If you're following, we said there's two passages, right? In chapter 47 is when Yaakov asks Yosef to bury him in Canaan. In that interaction, he should say, and I know, I buried your mother, you know, on the way, and I didn't take her there. In that last interaction, here, this has nothing to do with it. Over here, what are we talking about? We're not talking about burial. The burial discussion is over. We haven't talked. We're good. Yosef said, okay, he swore, he double swore. We're totally good on that end. That's over. New chapter, new page, new story, right? He's now here, and he's getting, and Yaakov says, by the way, I got this blessing from God, and then I want to give you the blessings to your children. Oh, and by the way, your mother died on the way. So you're in good company, but we have a strong question, Rashi. What in the world is this doing here? Yes.
I have a theory that just came to my mind.
Go for it.
So he is attempting to mitigate the fact that Rachel only has two children. Bilhah and Zilpah have two. Leah has all these other children.
Mm-hmm.
Had Rachel not died, who knows? Maybe she could have been comparable to Leah, but that was the end.
Okay.
By making three
out of two,
he is elevating Rachel. He's mitigating her status vis-a-vis Leah.
Excellent. So let me take what you said a little bit further. The Malbim says something similar, but he brings it back to the text a little bit more. He says like this. Remember the bracha that was given to Yaakov, that Yaakov just reminded us of? What was in that bracha? He said, I'm going to have what you're, Yaakov, you're going to have nations come from you. Now, Yaakov at that point had how many children? When he's returning from, how many children were born out? He had 11 children.
11
children. He has this blessed, this appearance. God appears to him, this vision, as he's traveling, as he enters back into the land of Israel. And God says, you're going to have children, not a child, but children. And then Rachel dies in childbirth, and the only one who's born is Binyamin. Oh, now we have a problem, right? You said, God said, you're going to have children, and you only have a child. So to your point, similar to your point, the Malbim says, and that's why Yaakov mentions this whole thing. He's saying that God promised me children. And then my primary wife died immediately afterward, after only having one child. It must be that there's children that are supposed to come from somewhere. It's you, Yosef. Your two children are going to be the fulfillment of that blessing. Okay? So the Malbim then explains the connection between why he mentions the death, the passing, is not as a justification, not as a way of apologizing or anything like that. It's just explaining that it makes sense if I was promised to have a multiplicity of children, and then my primary wife died, it must be they're coming from somewhere else. Where is that? It must be grandchildren and not children, and really, there are nations coming from me. Similar idea to what you said. Okay. So far, we've been saying everything according to what I would argue is the pshat. However, let's go back to the Hamikdavar. The Hamikdavar told us something very interesting. Very interesting, right? The Hamikdavar said the first time that Yosef appears in the first episode, in chapter 47, Yosef comes before Yaakov, he does something for him, and then instead of bowing to Yosef, he bows in that direction as a way of saying, I'm not bowing to you. The Hamikdavar continues that line of thinking. The Hamikdavar says something very strange about this verse. He says that, like this, he says that where a person dies in the ancient world. Let's just take a step back. You know, in Parshas Chayesara, there is a lot of dialogue between the people of Ches, the Hittites, who lived in Hebron, and Avram about burying Sarah in that land. The first time that Avram asks to bury Sarah, what do they say? No problem, you could bury her. We'll give you a plot of land to bury her. But yeah, Avram's not comfortable with that. He wants an actual piece of land. He wants there to be land and a burial place within his land. He's not comfortable just having a burial spot. He wants a burial, like more than a plot. He wants land to bury his wife there. Why is that so significant? It's significant, something that we wouldn't understand in our world. In our world, where you are born is where your nationality is, right? If you're born in the United States, you are an American. Born in Canada, like myself, I'm Canadian, right? So wherever you're born, that's where...
Not everywhere in Germany, it isn't like that.
Okay, how does it work in Germany?
My brother was born in Germany, but he's not a German. He was born in a DP camp.
Interesting. Okay, interesting. I don't know. Okay, so most places, I think in our modern world, that works that way, but you're right, could be. In the ancient world, many historians point out that your nationality, I know this sounds strange to us, but the nationality revolves around where you're buried. Because where you're buried, that's your permanent home. So a person being buried somewhere, obviously it has no significance to them per se, but it has implications to the family. It has implications to how we look at this person. The tension when Avram is trying to buy a piece of land from the people there, they said, oh, you can bury here. We'll give you like a strange, you know, like in every burial plot, you know, they have, you can't afford to buy a plot. Sure, we'll bury you here. We're not going to, but he said, no. I want this to be my land. I want to have a place, a bekavadik, like an honorable place, which is mine because this is my land. Her being, and they're pushing back on that. That's part of the tension. Where you're buried is defines who you are. Define, right? That's your eternal living place. That's why people make such an emphasis to be buried, like Yaakov, to be buried in the land of Israel, right? It's not enough to be buried, to live in it. I want to be buried in Israel. Why? Because that defines who you truly are. It's not just that when Mashiach comes, it's going to be easier. No, it's a statement. My real connection is where I am buried, right? So the Hamikdavar says, with that in mind, he says that since, your mother died in a strange place. She died on the side of the road. And that, he says, indicates that there is something. So where you die is where you really are. That's your real identity. If she dies on the side of the road, not in a place of habitation, that means that something is lacking in your inheritance. There's something lacking in your family's inheritance. In Rachel's descent, connection to the land, something is lacking. Binyamin was still, she dies right as Binyamin is being born. So he says it can't be about Binyamin. Rather, it's about you, Yosef. There's something wrong with the inheritance of one of her children. I see that in the death on the side of the road. And therefore, that's all he says. That's why, the Hamikdavar says, that's why he is mentioning this death of Rachel over here. Okay, so let's just wrap our heads around this, right? So again, the point that the Hamikdavar is saying is that since your mother died in a strange way, there's something broken in your connection to the land. So let's unpack this. So what is he saying? Therefore, what's the continuation? Therefore, when he says that Ephraim and Menashe are going to get an inheritance of the lands, is this a blessing or is it something else? Right? If he's saying that your connection to the land is, until now we've been learning, the simple way of understanding these psukim is that Yaakov is trying to give something extra to Yosef. Yosef, you're the one who's caring for me. Yosef, you're my beloved son. Yosef, your children need extra spiritual connection, whatever. Therefore, I'm going to give them double. But the Hamikdavar is saying, no, something is, we're looking at it wrong. It's not there's something double. There is a notice. Yes, Ephraim and Manasseh are getting something, but that means that Yosef is being skipped over, right? There is something missing by giving it to Ephraim and Manasseh. He's taking it away from Yosef. And so really the message, the Hamikdavar says, we're on the wrong track. Whole different thing. This whole section over here is actually Yaakov saying there's something wrong with you, Yosef. Your connection, Rachel's connection to the land is there's something missing, and that's why it's going to pass over you and go to your children. Right? We're starting to see this passage in a radically different, but this is consistent. Remember, according to the Netziv, when Yaakov gives, wants to thank Yosef, what does he do? He bows in the opposite direction. There's this tension over here between Yaakov and Yosef. What's that tension all about? So are y'all with me? I know this is like an earth-shattering idea because it's very different than we think. If we have to think, what tension would there be between Yaakov and Yosef? Yes?
In my opinion, it isn't Yosef's fault.
Okay.
It happened. I mean, he didn't want to be a slave.
Good.
He didn't ask for any of that.
100%. I don't just...
And why would the father now... punish him.
Good. So why would the father punish him? So let's read on a tiny bit, right? Let's see. We don't know yet. You're assuming that the reason that Yaakov is mad at Yosef is because of spending time, because of what happened, and you're saying it's not his fault. But maybe that's not what he's mad about it. Let's keep on reading, okay? So let's go, what pasuk are we up to? Verse 8, okay? Pasuk Ches. Vayar Yisrael el ben esbenei Yosef. Yisrael saw the children of Yosef. Now that's interesting. He sees them. He's told a moment before, Yosef is coming with his children. And now he sees them. He sees there's people here. Okay? Vayomer mi'ela. Who are they? It's a bit of a funny question. right? And you were just told that they're here. So maybe again, we're going to assume, as many do, that that Yaakov can't see so well. Still, we're going to assume he's also sound of mind. And he was just told that Yosef is coming with his two sons. He sees three people there. Who are they? Funny question. Vayomer Yosef el Aviv. He says to Yosef, says to his father, Banayhem, they are my children, Asher Nasan Li Elokim Bazeh, who God gave me, Bazeh. What does Bazeh mean? Like, with this?
With what?
And we'll come back to that question. Vayomer, and he says, Kachem na alai v'avarchem, and come bring them close to me, and I'll bless them. In the next verse, it says, Ve'eni Yisrael kavdu mizoken lo yuchal liros. He couldn't see, he's old, and he can't see so well. And therefore explains the next part of the psukim that he mixes up his hands with Ephraim and Manasseh. But it seems like within the first question, he saw them enough that he knew what it was. He still asks, who are they? And Yosef gives this cryptic answer, Banayhem, they're my children, Asher Nasan Lakim Li Bazeh, who gave them to me through this. So what's this dialogue over here? So someone is suggesting, again, going along the lines of the Hamigdavar, incorporating something from Dr. Leon Kass, want to suggest that when Yaakov asks this question, who are these people? You can ask that question. There's a literal way of asking that question. Who are these people? And there's like a figurative way of asking that. Who are these people? What would the figurative way of asking who are these people be? I think a year or two years ago in Shul one year, I didn't have anything to say for Parshas Vayechi. So I just printed out a bunch of pictures painted by different Christian artists, and we analyzed the pictures of Yaakov blessing his children. Okay, I don't know. I guess I'm the only one who remembers that. Anyway, the point is, in those pictures, there's actually a very interesting thing about how Ephraim and Manasseh are depicted. Some depict them wearing what we call like Jewish clothes in the ancient world, and some have them looking rather Egyptian, right? Looking rather Egyptian. So someone suggests that what's happening over here is now Yaakov turns to Yosef. Who are these people? They're dressed, shaven heads like the Egyptian. They're dressed in all the Egyptian clothing. I don't recognize these people. I don't know who they are. They're not my children. They're not my children. They're not my family. They don't look Jewish. Jewish people had, as our sages tell us, very distinct dress from the Egyptians. And so perhaps the question over here is not a literal question of, I don't know who these people are, but rather it's a accusatory question saying, I don't recognize these people. And what does Yosef respond? So some want to suggest that he's saying, they're the children that God gave me. He said, no, I believe in God. Bazeh. What is Bazeh? Bazeh is everything around you. Look, the only way I could survive, Bazeh, is this world, the palace that you're living in, the world, the food that we have. God gave me this. God put me in this position. And I had to adopt an Egyptian name, Egyptian practice. I had to adopt this in order to survive, in order for the family's survival, right? He's trying to justify why he is dressed, he himself, Yosef, and the children don't look very, quote unquote, Jewish. I know that's not the right term to use, but they don't look like Bnei Yisrael. They don't look like the children of Yaakov. They look like this because Bazeh, this is the only way we are going to survive is by assimilating to some extent. But if that's the dialogue, then we could trace our entire story back and understand that we understood the whole thing wrong. Let's go back to the beginning, the first passage, the very first passage. What's going on? Yaakov calls Yosef over and says, Yosef, I want you to swear to me that you'll bury me in Israel. And we asked, why does he turn to Yosef? And we gave a couple of explanations, which all are possibly true. But there could be something else. And we said, not only did he tell him to tell it, Yosef says, I'll do it, no problem. And then he says, that's not enough. Swear to me that you'll do it. He already said, I'm going to do it. I swore to. No, swear again. What's it all about? And so someone suggests this wasn't a practical conversation. Yaakov was sure that his children, by hook or by crook, they're not pushovers. Shimon and Levi, they'll make sure that he gets buried in it. This wasn't a practical discussion. This was trying to impress upon Yosef the following idea. You know where you need to be buried? You need to be buried in Israel. That is what matters. Your connection to this land, you feel like you're powerful and you're the second to command and you're everything. It's all fake. It's all fake. Our real connection is the land of Israel. And so it wasn't a practical dialogue about who's the one. He was trying to impress upon Yosef, there's something missing with your identity. And that was the entirety of that conversation. Yes, again, there was a practical element, but the main focus was the most important thing, Yosef, is to recognize we do not belong here. This is not really our land. Our real land is Israel. Yes.
Yosef got the message.
How so?
Because later on...
Very good.
He wants to be sure that he will be buried in Israel.
Jenny, you're killing the drama of my class. I'm just kidding. I'm just joking. I so strongly agree. We'll come back to that point. You're right. You're right. But Yaakov's not done, though. Good. We're going to come back to your point. You're so right. And the second point, I'm just joking around. I'm sorry. I'm just kidding. But the second dialogue, what does he do? He says, come. And what does he tell him again? According to this bit of a strange read, but the Netziv says, telling him about the death of, the death of his mother is to say, there's something missing in your connection. How do I know there's something missing? Because for all these years, you didn't come back home. You immersed yourself deeper and deeper and deeper into the Egyptian way of life, right? There's something lacking in your connection to the land. And therefore, Yosef is being punished. He's being told, again, according to the Hamikdavar, is that you don't have a connection. There is no tribe of Yosef that is buried in Mitzrayim. Instead, Ephraim and Manasseh. It's going to stay in the family. It's a light patch, right? But at the end of the day, there's a very strong message that Yaakov is trying to convey. You, Yosef, you're an Egyptian. You're an Egyptian. My grandchildren, they're the ones who are connected. Practically, you know, some of the commentators are a whole puzzled by this whole thing. Does it really make a difference if it's a, you know, at the end of the day, the land is divided by, there's a whole debate about how the land was divided. Was it divided by populace or not? Like, some point out that practically made no difference if you say there's 12 tribes, 13 tribes, 15 tribes, who cares? The land is going to be divided by populace. The answer to that, at least according to this approach, is to say it wasn't a practical point. Yes, Yosef's family was going to inherit the land of Israel. But Yaakov is trying to convey to him, you are missing in your connection. It's Ephraim and Manasseh. And therefore, again, it's a, not a curse, but a rebuke when he goes ahead and he says Ephraim and Manasseh are like Reuben and Shimon, but you, Yosef, you're not, right? And so all of this, and then when he turns to Yosef at the end, he says, who are they? That's a continuation of his criticism. My grandchildren, they don't look. They don't look the way they're supposed to. They don't look like our family. Right? But finally, so writes this whole episode, right? So let's just quickly summarize. The simple approach over here is that Yosef is getting something extra. Yosef is all powerful. Yosef is still his beloved son. And he's bringing him in and saying, you, Yosef, you're in charge of bearing me. You, Yosef, are going to get a double inheritance. It's all roses. It's all beautiful. The darker approach by the Hamikdavar and others, again, it's not only the Netziv, but others is saying that he's really giving him a powerful rebuke about his lack of connection to Israel. He's being asked to bury, he's saying, bury me in Israel, to teach him about the importance of the land. And again, there's a punishment for not calling Yaakov earlier, for not connecting to him. And therefore, Yosef is not connected to the land. It's always Ephraim and Manasseh connected to the land. And so this whole passage is a punishment. But to Jenny's very, very, very important point, you know, the story has a happy ending. Because at the end, the last few psukim of this week's parsha, the last few psukim of Bereishis, what are we told? Yosef turns to his family on his deathbed and he says, I get it. You know, and there's actually, I'll just add one point. You know, right before that passage in the Torah, the brothers come to Yosef and they concoct a bit of a story. They say, Yosef, you know, our father said before he died that you should forgive us. And, could you make sure to forgive us? You know, they send this whole message to Yosef. And they say, Yosef, you know, our father wanted to make sure that we're all in good terms. And therefore, could you forgive us? And what does Yosef do? Yosef starts crying, right? And he says, of course, I forgive you, et cetera, et cetera. What's that passage all about? So clearly the brothers didn't feel connected to Yosef. The point is as follows. They come to him and obviously they feel at a distance. Now when Yosef turns around and cries, Rav Lichtenstein and others point out, he's crying tears of loneliness. Imagine. Yosef tried so hard to reunite the family. If you remember from a few weeks ago, we said, according to Rav Hirsch, the whole reason he didn't reach out to them right away is because he wanted to make sure they weren't just physically close to each other, but they were really united. And they still suspect that he doesn't like them. He feels so alone, right? And so he gets this rude awakening. The tears that he cries then are not tears of longing. They're tears of sadness. My family still doesn't, I made a mistake. I should have reached out to them earlier. I tried, and I still don't feel this connection. And basically, Yosef feels incredibly isolated. And so perhaps that's a bit of a, between Yaakov's criticism and that last episode, there's a wake-up call to Yosef. You know, Yosef got comfortable in Egypt. He got comfortable in Egypt, and he thought he was doing the right thing, but in doing so, He lost a connection to his father for all those years. And in doing so, he never was able to properly reunite with the family. He thought he was going to, but he was left alone. And so at the end, you know, it's this sad awakening. It's a very tragic end to the book of Bereishis, where Yosef on his deathbed says, you know, I realize, you know, I made a mistake. I should have come home, so to speak, a lot earlier. I should have realized a lot earlier this is not my home. And therefore, as Jenny pointed out, what are his final words? God will save you and take my bones with you. I also want to be buried in Eretz Yisrael. I also want to be buried in Canaan. I also recognize that I should have so many years earlier gone back because this is not my home. So it's a powerful rebuke to Yosef, but I would argue, you know, just not to lose sight of the fact that ultimately, you know, one of the greatnesses of Yosef is that he learns his lesson, and he's able to learn the lesson, able to recognize at the end that he should have been buried in Eretz Yisrael, and he tries at the end to at least leave a message to his family that to recognize that his true home, not to lose our, and it's a message for all of us, certainly here, you know, we have homes, we have this, we have that. Our real connection is to our family, our real connection is to the land, and to not lose sight of that. Okay, thank you. Yes, Peter.